This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. Hinchliffe Stadium in Paterson, New Jersey, the home to many Negro League games, has recently been declared a National Historic Landmark. It was also where a semi-pro all-black team, the Smart Set, played primarily in the 1930s. The third baseman for many of those seasons, John Ellerbe, is my guest tonight on Sports Jam. And later in the show, we'll be joined by his daughter, Rosalyn, who used to watch Dad belt the baseball. Joining us now from his home on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, is 102-year-old John Ellerbe, who just happens also to be the cousin of the late jazz trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. John, thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
You're welcome.
It's very exciting to talk to you, John. You played at Hinchliffe Stadium in Paterson. The locals called it Hinchcliffe Stadium because it was actually on a cliff by the Great Falls in Paterson. You also played on many parks as part of the Smart Set team. Can you take us back to that time between the white lines? What was it like being on the Smart Set?
I enjoyed playing baseball with Larry Doby and Monty Irvin, Ollie Wright, Cody Harris. Oh, we had fun. Monty Irvin played shortstop. Larry Doby played first base, and I played third base. But I could play any place, but I couldn't. I never tried catching behind home plate. But my batting average was always from 375 to 385. I had the highest batting average of any player around. Not bragging on myself, but I'm just telling you the way it were.
Why were you so good at the plate?
You've got to have good eyesight. My eyes were so great at that time, the baseball looked like a softball coming up. And I did sometime a whole season, I wouldn't strike out for a whole summer. I was that good with the bat. The major leagues, why they passed me back, I was married and had one child. They were looking for young people that was in high school and things like that so they could send them to the minors. Being a married man and had a wife and a child, they just passed me by and went on and took the younger players. And that was when they first started to taking in the Negro players. Because Jackie was in, then came Doby, and they were so well-trained, they never had to go to the minors. Monty Irvin and Doby didn't go to the minors. They just left our team and went right on to the majors.
Did you ever want to go to the Negro League professional team, the Newark Eagles?
No, because our team in Paterson was just as great. But Doby went down there. And in those days, you didn't think about going to the majors because they wouldn't have you. They wouldn't take you in the majors. Each city had bragging rights with baseball teams. We had some great teams we played against right there in Paterson. One great team we played with was the Chevrolet players, the Chevrolet companies, the new Chevrolet company. I don't know whether it was General Motors or who, but Chevrolet sponsored them. My team was sponsored by hardware stores all across America. At that time, was called Allwell Hardware. And we just went in that hardware and picked up whatever kind of tools we needed, bats. They would always send me to get the bats because I had the highest bat there. And I'd go in there and pick out five or six good bats at a time. Whatever you needed to play with, you went to their store and they had most anything you needed to play baseball with in the hardware store.
John, why didn't you try to move up to the professional ranks of the Negro Leagues?
Well, I didn't need to go down there. I was playing just as well. And I was a married man, and we didn't see leaving your wife and child in those days. It was different from the day. You didn't make any money. I made more money working at the garage than you did playing baseball.
But you would have made some money, though, if you'd have played for the Eagles, though, right?
You'd have made peanuts, and then you wasn't sure of a job. And I'm telling you, it's not like it used to, and I'm not going against my own people. But most of the managers would do just like some politicians do today. They would pocket all the money and the players got peanuts. I remember Jackie Robinson wrote about that after he got in the majors, how we were treated under those managers.
Who was the toughest pitcher you faced and why?
I don't know. I don't think I was struck out by one pitcher And I went back. His name was Jack Yeoman. Played on one of the white teams in Patterson. He struck me out, and I was so shocked, and so was the people in the stand at me striking out. It was when the slider first came out. So I went back, and I said to my manager, what kind of pitch did he get me on? I said, the ball was coming straight at the plate. I said, in the last second, it just dipped away. He said, that's that new pitch they call the slider. And that's the only time I remember ever striking out in a game.
What was the dynamic like when an all-black team would play an all-white team in Patterson?
Most of the fans seemed to be rooting for us, you know, and because they wasn't used to seeing blacks playing against their teams. And the most of them root, but the worst surprise, we went to play in Toms River, New Jersey. Now, we lived in New Jersey, played in New Jersey. But when we went to Toms River, they were so prejudiced down there until the only place we could dress was in the firehouse. They wouldn't even let us into their white dressing room. We played, but my manager had booked us down there, and he didn't have any idea that there was that much prejudice right there in New Jersey.
What did people say to you?
You got in there, you make a good play on third base. All right, old N, you know, the N-word would be used, and I yelled out right in New Jersey, and it was that bad. Because in South Jersey at the time, the migrant workers came there, blacks, picked more beans than the whites. They feathered them like a chicken, put feathers all over, put tar on them, and then feathered the man and his wife right there in New Jersey. It wasn't Mississippi, New Jersey, South Jersey. This is true because it was all on the front page of the New York News at the time.
We're speaking with John Ellerbe on Sports Jam. John, you were born in South Carolina. How did you end up in Patterson, New Jersey?
Oh, getting to New Jersey. I worked at 15 years old. I was working in Lawnburg, North Carolina at the biggest lumber company in the South. Sinclair and McLeod was the name of the company.
Just for clarification, you lived in South Carolina, but you actually worked in North Carolina.
We were so near to the dividing line, until you could 5 or 10 minutes, you could cross the line and be into the other state. So I moved to North Carolina after I stopped farming and got a job at the lumber mill. I was 15 years old then. They give me the most dangerous job, running the swing saw. It was a saw that spun so fast, you would swear it was standing still. I had to cut the measurements of all lumber that went through that company with that powerful saw. And it would just go through a sill. They had sills in those days instead of steel today. Big beams of wood, they call them seals in the South. Then I left that. I had brothers in the North, and my mother and my brothers were in the North by that time. I had one brother went to the North 27 years before that. And then he came back South and saw how poor we were living in the South. He says, you're going up North. He sent Cadillacs down there, limousines, to pick the family up. Well, there wasn't any room for me, so I stayed there and worked. And my brother says, I'll send you the money, and you come on the train the next week. That was the first time I'd ever rode on a train in my life, alone. I got on the train in Lawnburg, North Carolina, went to Hamlet, North Carolina, and got the main line to take you on up. Well, there was so prejudice on the railroad at the time, we couldn't sit in the car with the whites. All the way up, I'd never been on a train, frightened to death, had never left South Carolina and North Carolina in my life. Every time the train would go to stop at any little stop, I'd say, is this New Jersey? Because that's where I was heading for. Is this New Jersey? I pestered that conductor on the train till he said, they'll let you know when you get to Newark, New Jersey. He said, but you won't get to Newark, New Jersey until tomorrow, he said. All night long, every time the train would pull by, and is this New Jersey? I was scared to death. The next day at 3 o'clock, my brother met me at the train. The brother up north met me at the train. He says, "Where are your clothes?" I said, "I've got them on. All the clothes I had them on." He just, and because when I was working, running this dangerous saw, I was paid $7 a week, a whole week for $7. And running the dangerous saw, could have been killed at any minute.
John, when did baseball come along for you? When did you start playing this game?
I played baseball from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I had so many brothers and one sister until we could farm two teams every Saturday afternoon. We stopped all farm works. That was our time off, Saturday afternoon. My father let give us off. We would get together and play each other. When I was 5 or 6 and on up, played baseball every time we wasn't working, I was playing baseball. All my life, all the way up, was baseball. And the things I cared the most about in those days was the girls and baseball.
I've heard that from other ball players. Tell me what you like about baseball.
The fun in this, you'll get to the place when you hit that ball and hit it hard and hit it right. It gives you a feeling, and it's the sound. When you hit a baseball hard like I used to hit the baseball, I used to say there's no use to hitting the baseball if you're going to hit it so weak until it's going to dribble down there to the pitcher or to the shortstop. I just hit the ball so hard, that's why my average was so high. I didn't believe in hitting the ball lightly. I hit it with all my power. And I was a right-hand batter, but I could hit the ball out the park to right as much as I could to the left. Because if they pitched me a curveball on the outside corner, you're facing that direction, the right field, so you hit the ball in that direction. You better hit it hard. Don't try to pull everything. That's the trouble with a lot of the hitters today, to try to pull the ball a certain way. Just hit the baseball. And if you hit it hard enough and far enough, no one's going to get it.
So you were 5'9", 175 pounds. So I would imagine you had some muscles at the time.
Well, you born in the South. Look at Hank Aaron, how skinny he was. Them people born in the South did so much hard work and built their bodies up so and ate the right type of food. They had that good old buttermilk and cornbread and hoghead cheese and all that kind of thing, and they even ate chitlins. They had food in them that made them strong. They'd come up eating strong. Other people that wasn't brought up down there don't know what it's like and be prejudiced. That's why you see so many blacks today is better in some things than others, because they got the strength from the way they were brought up. They were brought up doing heavy, tough work. They didn't have to go through all this spring training. They was trained enough working on those farms, cutting the wood, plying the farms, butchering the hogs, the cows, milking the cows, and all those things you had to do. You did it for yourself. And in those days, there wasn't any place to take it to have it fixed. If you broke a part on a wagon or something, you fixed the wheel yourself. My father could do anything that I think on earth. He could build houses. He built schools. He built churches and everything. But we did it. You did it all on your own. You didn't have any help. My grandfather used to hit the ball so hard and so far in open parks they had in those days. They had a mule that they put the saddle on the mule. And when he'd come to bat, they'd say, "Get the mule. Henry Ellerby's coming to bat." And he would hit the ball so far, he'd run and get the ball on the mule back and bring it back, because they didn't have that many baseballs to go around like today. They have more balls in one game than they had in a lifetime down there.
Some of the greatest Negro League players of all time played at Hinchcliffe Stadium, and your team played at Hinchcliffe Stadium. So I imagine you were excited to hear that Hinchcliffe Stadium has been declared a National Historic Landmark.
Oh, that was beautiful. And when Josh Gibson, Statue Page catcher, would come there, Garrett Mountain was on the outside of the stadium there. he would hit the ball right on over that mountain. They'd have police up on that part of Garrett Mountain to keep people from walking up there watching the game without paying. There'd be policemen up there. They'd have to watch Josh Gibson to keep him from knocking him off that mountain. The man was the most powerful person I've ever seen in my life. He wasn't fat, but he was big. And around his wrist was like the large part of your legs. He was just that built, that strong, and that powerful. He was the greatest catcher I've ever seen.
A lot of people have said that maybe Josh Gibson was the best baseball player ever. He just never got a chance to play in the major leagues
That's
to show
right.
everybody.
That's it. He was a catcher. You couldn't steal on him. He was so quick and so fast. But he had little feet and small legs down below. And his feet didn't get in his way. But he was great. He could throw. He could hit. And I mean, he hit all the time. You didn't pitch to him unless you wanted the ball hit out of the park.
You only got a chance to watch him, right? You never played on the same team or against him, did you?
No. He came there to play at times after I quit playing. You see, I got smashed in the face, and that's what caused me to stop playing.
Tell me about that, John.
I wanted to win all the time. I went into second base standing up instead of sliding, and the shortstop fired that baseball right into my face. Even fractured the bone in the face. You could feel the crack in the bone under my right eye. And I just quit baseball after that.
You're listening to Sports Jam on WBGO Jazz 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest tonight is a cousin of the late Dizzy Gillespie, John Ellerby, and his daughter Roslyn now joins us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. John, your daughter watched a lot of your playing days.
You can hear Roslyn all over the stadium. Hit that apple, Daddy, because I would go home. You going to play today, Dad? I said, yeah, I'm going to hit that apple. Talking about the baseball. Well, she started calling the baseball apple. And she'd be yelling in the stands. You could hear all over the stands. Hit that apple, Daddy, when I come to the plate. She was one of my greatest fans.
So you were the little gal that said, hit the apple, Dad.
Hit the apple. And I would say that. Hit that apple, Dad. Hit that apple.
Roslyn, what do you remember about your dad's playing days?
Well, I was young, and I do remember weekends. I had a sister who has passed away. We were 6 years apart. But I remember that we went on the weekends or when we were not in school to watch my dad play. As he said, the parks then, Eastside Park, was one where I remember on Sunday afternoons. And he mentioned Wendell Williams' mother, Mrs. Della Cisco, would always encourage me, that's right, root for your dad, she used to say. And we would occasionally follow the team. We would get on the bus and go with the baseball team when they went to play out of town. So I do remember going to Tom's River. And as it got dark, I think they called the game. It was getting dark. And we had to be out of town before dark. There were sundown towns all over our nation. And I do believe at that time, Tom's River was in the category of sundown town.
What are your thoughts as you hear Dad describe his early days where he wasn't able to put his uniform on except for a couple of places? What does that do inside you when you hear that?
Well, I know that it happened. I know it probably gave him more strength, which he passed on to his family. He always had us to recognize our own strength that was within. We're strong, church-based, faith.
We're speaking with Rosalind Ellerby, the daughter of John Ellerby. Both are joining us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts for this edition of Sports Jam. You both are cousins of the late, great trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie.
Oh, yes. I found that out when I lived in Lawnburg. My brother and I had rented a house right by the dormitory where he went to school. Well, he wore that horn on his body all the time. I think he slept with that horn. Now, he was in school then. He was just a young fella. But he'd blow that horn in the dormitory and keep us awake. Now, you'd walk around the corner and you'd be where we live. He would come over there because, you know, in them college and them days, they didn't feed you the way they should. You went boarding school and staying there on the dorm, but they didn't take you. And he'd come around and eat with my brother and I when I was working at the lumber mill. We would cook up huge amounts of salmon and rice, huge pots. And here he would come with all his friends from the dormitory, come around there almost every night to eat rice and salmon. We'd cook a big pot full of rice and mix the salmon right in. And they would come there and just eat their bellies full. That's when we found out we were related. My father knew all about his family. He said, that's my cousin. His mother's my cousin, he said. Yeah, came from the same part, because Gillespie's family came the same part of the South my father came from.
So, John, you weren't surprised when Dizzy became a big star?
He was good then. Oh, he could blow that thing when he was young. He could toot that horn, and my brother would bawl him out of you can't sleep at night because they'd let him play music over there until 10 o'clock at night. That's when they'd put the lights out and make all the students go to bed. But you'd hear him tooting that horn because we were near the men's dormitory, our house.
Rosalind, I know that the Ellerbys are related to the Gillespies through marriage. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Dizzy Gillespie later in life?
No, although he did in later life live in Englewood. I think he passed away in Englewood, New Jersey. I mean, we knew he was there in Jersey, but I never had a chance to have a conversation with him.
Did you like his music?
Oh, yes, I still do.
What is it about Dizzy Gillespie's music and jazz in general that you like?
Well, music to me is the universal language. Everybody can understand it and can appreciate it. I love all kinds of music. I love jazz. I love opera. I love symphony. The classical music to me is just as all of it is tied together. And it should be pleasing, and everyone should enjoy it, no matter what genre you pick. So, yes, I enjoy jazz. Now, in the 50s, a group that used to come to D.C. in my college days that I would save up enough money was the Modern Jazz Quartet. Some of those members were Jersey, Milt Jackson on the vibraphone, and of course before him, my mother and father's days was Lionel Hampton. I mean, I grew up hearing the music in the house.
Oh, I lived. Count Basie was one of the greats, Duke Ellington. You had so many, and that's what I think about today. What happened to all the great stars, like Frank Sinatra and all the other stars that came on? They were just stars. You don't have nothing like that today. What happened to the people? What happened? Where did all the good people go? All the big bands is gone, and there's nobody can sing anymore the way they used to. It's just terrible. Now, this year, music they got now, where these kids making all this money. When we were kids, that's with games we played. This year they're chat, 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 you know, matching up words they use today. Hip-hop. Now, that was nothing. When we were kids, we would hambone, yeah, and we would beat on our thigh. You'd hold up one leg and beat the sound and the dance part on your thigh with your hand open, like you're slapping. Ham-boon, ham-boon skin. Ham-boon, throw it down, pick it up again. This needed the word we would do with the kids. Now, we were just playing games. Didn't know that. Didn't never think this stuff, what I call nothing but junk today, would ever be anything, because we didn't know.
John, what everybody's going to ask you, I'm sure everybody's asked you through the years, what's the secret to having a long, wonderful life?
Eating the good food I ate all through the South. Staying away from drinking. Staying away from smoking. I never smoked a cigarette in my life. The doctors tell me today that's why you're still around here and so strong and can still garden. Because when the warm weather come, I'll be out there in my garden growing tomatoes and butternut squash. And I grow some of everything you can think of every year and give all that food away to the neighborhood because I grow so much of it.
As he said, he gardens, but his other hobby or activity that keeps him active, he cooks. He is a gourmet cook.
What does he make?
Anything and everything. He made a big pot of stew beef with vegetables yesterday with the side dish of rice, being South Carolina. We're heavy rice eaters rather than potatoes. So he felt like having a big stew beef and he from scratch. It has to be the fresh vegetables, none of this canned stuff. Every now and again, some frozen vegetables, but he wants fresh. So he grated his carrots and cut up his celery and did his onions. Anyway, it may take 3-4 hours, but he sits there patiently and prepares everything and gets it going and watches a little TV while things cook. And he has me as the sampler to taste it as he goes along. He makes pies from scratch. He'll buy the Pillsbury dough. But he uses the fresh peaches and whatever is in season, the berries, the peaches, the whatever, and makes pies and peach cobblers or whatever. So whatever he thinks he might want, he sent me for eggplant. He's going to make a big eggplant parmesan. That's one of his favorites. From scratch, so I got him a couple of eggplants, so in a day or so he'll do a Parmesan casserole. So it's keeping him busy, and I'm writing down his recipes.
Rosalind, as we wrap up this edition of Sports Jam, let's go back to the Diamonds just for a moment. Who was your favorite baseball player? I know you're a big baseball fan.
Well, you start with Dad.
That makes sense.
I start with my grandfather. My grandfather also played ball back in the South. He was a catcher. And I would hear my dad talk about how his father was a terrific hitter and a catcher. And they just grew up playing ball, all the boys.
Hey, John, I understand you had an opportunity to play the first AME Zion Church in Patterson when they had Benjamin C. Robeson on the team, Paul Robeson's brother. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
So you weren't always a third baseman. You actually pitched, too.
I had another team that was owned by my family then. Patterson was called the Blue Jays. But my team wasn't up as high. The Smart Sets needed a good player. And they asked me to come over and play. Well, after I went over to play with the Smart Sets, the team Blue Jays folded up.
So I know you never got to meet Paul Robeson, but what was his brother like, and what kind of baseball player was he?
Oh, he was a big-time minister of the Zion Church in Patterson. He was a great man. Everybody loved him.
Was he a good ball player?
Oh, yes. He was the pitcher on that team. You should see him when we would beat him. Oh, man. He would be so excited, so heartbroken, and whatever. He didn't want to lose. And he was quite a pitcher. He was a good pitcher.
Did you play the first AME Zion Church at Hinchliffe Stadium?
No, in the open park. See, Patterson had baseball parks, and West Patterson on each side of the Passaic River was a beautiful baseball diamond. Eastside Park was one of the finest baseball open outdoor parks in the country. And you had Owen Hawthorne and all, every little town around there had a beautiful baseball park. They would send people out to lay down the white lines even when you didn't have games. Things would run so different then from today. Those same parks today is grown up, turned into dumps or something else. Don't you wouldn't even know the place if you saw it today. It's that much of a change.
One thing that didn't change for you, John, is your approach to hitting.
When you go to the bat, I don't care how much you heard about another pitcher, you got to believe you can hit him. Because if you go up there doubting, oh, I can't hit him, he's throwing, you won't even foul the ball. You have to believe in yourself to be good at anything.
Mr. Ellerby, final thoughts on being a part of the Smart Set?
Well, I didn't have no regrets, nothing about baseball at all. I don't have no regrets. I don't look back. I keep looking forward. Whoever you are, be noble. Whatever you do, do well. Whenever you speak, speak kindly. Give joy wherever you dwell. And that's what I believe in. I'm up here on Cape Cod, and I'm living happily. We bought land up here when things were cheap, built homes. And we're doing, I guess, better than some of the majors, because some of the majors make the big money and then throw it all away. But we don't have any regrets whatsoever.
Rosalind Ellerby, you had a long, successful teaching career in Patterson. We thank you so much for joining us here on Sports Jam.
I thank you for calling and talking with us.
John Ellerby, you are an inspiration to so many people, and we appreciate your time here and sharing some of your wonderful stories on Sports Jam.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcast versions of the show by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam. Or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Special thanks this week going out to Jimmy Richardson's Freedom Boulevard Project. Jimmy helping us hook up with the Ellerbys. Join me next Wednesday at 7:30 for another edition of Sports Jam. My guest will be former Knicks great Earl the Pearl Monroe. Until our next session, I'll see you at the game.